This episode is brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. Made with a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. To learn more, visit RT11.com.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll, Lord. Knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The devil runs his groove in them rhythm and blues that Sam is gonna get you some.
Welcome back to the Speakeasy. I'm Souther Teague.
And I'm Greg Benson.
Greg, how are you, buddy?
I'm doing all right, man. I'm hanging in there. How are you doing?
I mean, it's a hot one here in New York City. And of course, you know, in our virtual studios, that means that I'm sitting at home in a makeshift fort made out of pillows and blankets with my AC and my fan off because we don't want to have background noise on the show. So, you know.
It's hard, but we do it for you, listeners. We do it for you.
We suffer for our art, indeed. you know, or our craft, or whatever the hell this is we do. But still just slogging along as far as all of the continued and updated regulations go on how I have to operate my businesses, even though they're operating at a loss. And, you know, just trying to, frankly, currently at this point, it's PR. Greg, I'm just trying to make sure that my audience knows that I'm still here and I'm still fighting. But it's, you know, it literally is a cost. We're running at minimum double the labor and about a quarter of the revenue to operate as safely as we can with limited outdoor seating. And now we have to offer food, which that ups the labor and also the cost of goods. So, you know, just trying to get to the other side of it in as whole of a piece as I can. And then hope that we can fight back from there. But frankly, with every passing day, you know, I'm hopeful but not confident we're going to make it.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Well, I was having a conversation on Monday about a pretty important piece of legislation that's up for vote, I believe, this week in the House, which we can get to a little bit with our guest. But one thing that we were talking about, one question that this person asked me is, what would you show a legislator, like if you were kind of taking them through on this A Christmas Carol Dickensian tour of New York City, what would you show someone who had a critical deciding vote on this aid package for restaurants to convince them? And I would say I would stand in front of a busy bar in the East Village, pick one. There are dozens, if not hundreds of them. And I would say, you know, I would stand in front of the tables that they've put up in front of in the parking spaces in front of their establishment. And I would pull up Instagram of just a random Friday or Saturday night from last year where it's just asses to elbows in that bar. And I would show them my phone and say, this is what they need. And then I would point to the three tables that they're allowed to have at a safe distance and say, this is what they have.
Yeah.
Like, it's not even close to enough, and it's providing a weird sense of normalcy that I'm getting warier and warier of by the day.
Yeah, and you know, I've got many. I totally agree. Of course, we're operating at far, far less than, you know, even quarter capacity, frankly. And I've got many of my staunch regulars and longtime fans who've reached out to me through various ways, you know, Instagram and social media and through direct texts and emails from some of them who know me closely, saying things like, you know, love you, want to support you, but I'm not coming out until this gets better. So, you know, right now, we also, though we have seats, they're not always full. And the reason that they're not full is because many people are still not confident in going out, you know, which means that even when we get to open back up inside, we're going to have consumer lack of confidence to be back in that, as you said, sort of elbow to asshole situation. No one's going to want to be that close to one another after now 4, 6, maybe even 8 months of being told remain 6 feet away from every other human being. So, you know, I think that what we're in right now is the long march up to the big fight. So we're being worn out by this, you know, beleaguered march where we're having to carry burdens and weights the whole way. And then when we get in the ring for the fight, which is reopening, we're all going to be exhausted, and who knows if we're going to make it. I've mentioned before on the air that the National Restaurant Association, the good NRA, predicts, they're predicting that 85% of all sole proprietorships will close by January. 85, 8.5 out of 10 sole proprietorships. And I'd be a fool if I thought myself impervious to that sort of statistic. So, you know, I'm, again, hopeful but not confident has been my mantra throughout this whole thing, that we'll make it through. And, you know, I don't know that we will, but I hope we do.
Same, man. I mean, that's kind of all you can do is be cautiously optimistic, or like, or well, not cautiously optimistic, hopefully pessimistic, I guess, whatever the opposite of that is. There we go.
I think that's more me. The cautious optimism comes from Damon, who couldn't be here today, sadly. But he's the yin to my yang on the show usually. So, you know, I hope I don't take us down too many dark roads. You'll have to keep shining the light on me.
Don't worry, I'll be the sunshine golden boy today. I think I can step into those shoes. Maybe not the hat, but possibly the boots.
So once again, operating from our COVID-friendly remote studios in our own homes and what have you. Greg, who we got in the fake studio today?
Well, today in our lovely and sweltering fake studio, we have Maxwell Britton. He's the managing partner at the Django and Roxy Hotel, and he is the state organizer for New York for Thirst, which is a really interesting and necessary organization that we're going to be talking about a lot today. Maxwell, thanks so much for joining us, man.
Hey, what's up, guys? How's it going?
Life is surreal and you know, uncomfortable, but we're healthy, so I think we can, you know, we'll keep going.
Yeah. Great. Yeah, I'm gonna be sunshiny.
Every day is a good day, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Maxwell, you and I have known each other for quite some time. You know, you were over at Maison Premier, which was just a few blocks away from Rye when I was over there. This was at this point over a decade ago, and we became friends way back then. So I'm super happy to have you on the show again. You've been on the show before, right?
Yeah, a couple times.
Yeah. And you reached out to me earlier this week because you're involved in this new thing. And I'll admit that my head is spinning with so many other things that I'm going to need you to explain it to me again, which is fine because we're going to do it in front of an audience. So let's just jump right into it. You know, what is Thirst and what are you guys trying to accomplish?
It's a lot. So there's a lot to unpack there. And yeah. I'll try to do it in the most comprehensive way I can. But please stop me at any time to ask me questions. Thirst is a 501c6 organization, which defines us as a not-for-profit lobby group. So we are entirely volunteer-based, and we are not doing this for money. We are doing this to support our industry and small businesses across the country. So what is it that we're doing for those people and for these industries? Well, we have a huge problem in our country with how insurance policies work for small businesses. So usually for most small businesses, people will have some kind of business interruption policy. So one big reason why you would have insurance is because you if there were a fire or a flood or there was some kind of something that caused you to have to stop making revenue for a certain period of time.
Sure, maybe a pandemic.
Yeah, so maybe a pandemic could be a part of that. So what's interesting though is it's the policies kind of vary from state to state, but more or less they're kind of all the same, and the bills that we have in legislation for these policies are pretty ambiguously interpreted. So yes, with the pandemic situation, most of these policies will have a clause that's either a no pandemic clause or a no virus clause. So basically what they're trying to say is that if a pandemic were to occur, that a pandemic would not trigger the business interruption insurance claim. However, there's a couple other kinds of ways that a business interruption claim should be triggered. So as I mentioned before, you could have a flood, you could have a fire. There's also something called civil action or civil commotion. So civil action could be something like when a government body mandates your private business into closure, which is what we have going on right now. So the way that we're looking at this in terms of the way that we're trying to change legislation on a state and on a national level is that we're not focused on the pandemic. You know, obviously that's occurring, but it's the result of the pandemic has created civil action, which is the closures that we're experiencing, or, you know, the partial operations that, you know, some bars are attempting to try to do. But, you know, like, I know, Souther, you were talking about some of your, you know, experiences right now with like operating at a loss. So those are that those you're taking a financial damages because of the civil action that's occurring during this time. So it's not just because it's not just for those businesses that are shut down and losing money. It's for all businesses that have been affected by the government policies that have been given to us by our policymakers.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I'm not a lawyer, and unless Souther's been holding out on me, I don't think he is either. I wanted to ask a quick question about that pandemic clause that you mentioned. It sort of seems to me that what was intended by that was like, you know, a business can't say, oh, it was a rough flu season, and wouldn't you know it, business was really slow in February. Pay me. You know, it seems like
right. It
wasn't designed for the unprecedented scale that we're experiencing now.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, that's absolutely correct. And I believe it is that they actually put that clause into effect whenever we had the SARS pandemic, which I can't remember what, I think it was maybe 2003, mm-hmm. Sometime around there. So yeah, that's kind of like when that occurred. But yeah, so I think what a lot of them are trying to say is basically, you know, well, this is a pandemic, so, you know, we're not going to approve your claim. And they can kind of get away with it because of the way that these bills are being interpreted, because they're so ambiguous, they're kind of leaning very heavily on this clause. And basically we're really challenging that as a lobby group by saying, well, we're not talking about a pandemic. We're talking about civil action. We're talking about civil commotion. We're talking about businesses that are losing their money because of government mandates that we're required to follow. So that gives you sort of an overview of who we are as a group and a little bit of what we do. But in terms of our action and in terms of our initiatives and strategy, there's quite a lot to be said about those things.
And who started all this? Who started Thirst?
So Nate Whitehouse, who's a co-founder and partner of Drifter Spirits and also co-founder of Avoa Cachaça. He's an attorney by trade, but everybody knows him in our industry pretty well for those brands that he's a part of. And basically just started out as him. I think he was just sort of advising people that were asking questions about, you know, some of these issues in April. And then he started putting together a town hall where just different leaders from our industry could get on the phone and ask questions. And we were all just kind of brainstorming what sorts of things we could do to try to support our industry during this time. And then we started seeing, you know, some of these I wouldn't call them loopholes, but just sort of actually like really just holes that we have in these bills that are in place that really support these insurance policies. And we started looking at like how much money is there in the National Reserve for that these insurance companies collectively hold. And we've discovered that they have around $847 billion in national reserves collectively. And we've been able to estimate that if we could even get every claim partially filled for every single business across the country, it would be around $380 billion. And that would be an actual lifeline for a lot of businesses that are suffering right now, because I think we all know, you know, the CARES Act and the PPP loans was definitely a failed experiment for a lot of people. And I know a lot of businesses that have ended up having to shut their doors permanently because it was a worse deal for them to try to take the loan than it was for them to shut down completely. So, you know, the way that our government is treating these issues right now is obviously with not very much sympathy or care. And that's also seen through the way that, you know, they're allowing the insurance lobby to kind of get away with this. And then they're sitting on all this money. And it's just the other thing that I think is very interesting is, I mean, there's a lot of different numbers flying around from the National Restaurant Association about how much money the hospitality industry contributes to the national revenue yearly. And I've heard figures go between $780 billion and like $1 trillion a year that we contribute to the economy, you know, combined with all of our businesses and suppliers and adjacent, you know, industries that are part of what we do. And I've also seen some figures for the insurance industry where they're also bringing in somewhere around $1 trillion a year annually as well. And so it's just very interesting to me that, you know, we've got two industries that contribute an equal amount to our, you know, to our economic health. And somehow we're still being swept under the rug. And, you know, we can make that comparison for a lot of other industries as well, because we've seen bailouts for banks, and we've seen bailouts for, you know, the travel industry, and we're seeing it in all these places. And it's just so unbelievable how much money we're bringing to the table, and we still don't have a seat at the table. So right. that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to change that right now.
Yeah, it seems a pretty simple solution that these two industries would, you know, prop each other up during this time when they're delivering, you know, a similar amount of revenue to the economy. You know, that number that you just said that the insurance industry takes in, they take it in from us, right? If we don't survive, then we're not paying our insurance bill, and then they're not, you know, making money. So it seems like bailing us out would be bailing themselves out. And as far as the federal government goes, well, they've obviously, you know, shown their cards, and they don't give a crap about the restaurant and bar industry. They bailed out the airlines, which, you know, restaurant and bars employ literally 15 times more people and contribute around the same amount of times more to the economy than airlines do. Yet we bailed them out instead of ourselves. And it's already been shown that many of them are taking those bailout dollars and just buying back their own stocks, which gives a sugar high to the stock market, and, you know, makes them look good and takes care of their investors and their stockholders. So, you know, this is a bunch of tough shit to chew on, especially for guys like us who are, you know, at our core, we're just hospitality guys. We just want to fucking show people a good time and do it in an interesting way, right? So what made you, Maxwell, take the initiative to move into this kind of space from the space that I just described, just one of hospitality and, you know, kind of a good time lifestyle?
Yeah, I know. It's I wouldn't have thought this was what I would be doing at this point in my career. But, you know, I've been in hospitality like you guys for a really, really long time, pretty much most of my life. And I've been a small business owner now for 5 years. And before that too, I mean, everybody, like anybody that works in the hospitality industry has multiple skill sets that you develop, you know, while you're in the trade. And yeah, we're best known for making great cocktails and showing people a great time. But behind all that, especially the further you go up in the business, especially once you become a business owner, you find out that there are all kinds of different things that you need to know that have nothing to do with drinks. You need to have a pretty good understanding of how finance works. You need to have a good understanding of marketing. You have to know a lot of legal stuff. There's all kinds of different sorts of legal things that we have to know and pursue as business owners. Obviously, we're talking about the insurance thing right now, and so I guess, you know, long story short, I've just was able to acquire quite a lot of different skill sets over this period of time, and I found that the culmination of all those things, especially certain aspects of like the social aspects of what we do, are actually quite transferable skills for like lobbying and activism, because it involves a lot of communication. It involves a lot of organization. It requires a lot of public speaking and networking and all kinds of different things that we've all done before, but you just don't think about how you would do that, you know, in a political sort of way. I mean, it's not something that we're all known for doing. We tend to try to leave those things at the door. You know, we usually don't let those kinds of things inside of the restaurants and bars because we're supposed to, you know, sort of create a fantasy, suspend a reality where people can kind of forget, you know, the world that's outside of the front door. But, you know, now that like we're kind of being forced to confront these issues, I'm like, well, I have to do something. I mean, this has been my career for my entire life. And I've just been watching it basically fall apart within the past 4 months. And I mean, I'm just not going to let it, I'm not going to sit around and watch it go down without putting up a fight. You know, it's just like, I just can't do that. It's who I am, you know, and I think most importantly, who we are as hospitality professionals is we're community leaders and we create community centers for people. And that to me is really what we do. And that is precisely what I'm doing now with Thirst.
Yeah. And you're somewhat uniquely positioned in both a good and bad way, right? Django is inside the hotel, so you can't even do the limited outdoor seating. So you've been kind of without, you know, a sort of adrift, right? Without a place to go or a purpose on a daily basis. So this is pretty timely for you that you have this time on your hands and this skill set that you've acquired over time that have stacked up to be this potential lobbyist.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, that is definitely my situation. And that's every single person that we know is undergoing a very different and a very unique circumstance, because we all have different kinds of business agreements and leases. And, you know, some of us have great landlords and some of us have piece of shit landlords. So it's just kind of like, you know, it's just sort of all over the place for a lot of us. And so My particular situation is pretty unique compared to some of our other friends in the fact that my business is inside of a hotel. We're also in the cellar level of the property, so you have to enter the building to go inside it. We don't rent any outdoor space, so we can't apply for sidewalk permits or anything like that. And the whole to-go cocktail thing, especially now, really doesn't make any sense for us. So we're basically forced to remain closed until whenever we can go back inside. But then in addition to that, the other thing that puts me in a very vulnerable position is that because I'm a part of a hotel, that's an entirely different industry that is getting hit as hard as we're getting hit right now. And now that we have all these domestic and international travel restrictions due to the way that our government has managed this pandemic, nobody's traveling.
Mismanaged.
Right. So nobody's traveling right now. And so in addition to all these other things that are making it impossible for me to open, even if I wanted to, there's people aren't going to New York City. They're not staying at hotels. There's Broadway is closed. And, you know, like we just barely had our zoos open up. There's still most of the indoor museums are still closed. And, you know, we can't go inside of our restaurant. So it's just sort of like all these, even if we didn't have these travel restrictions, why would you want to come to New York City? Half the things that make it what it is, the arts and the culture and the restaurants and bars and theater, all these things aren't here right now. So why would somebody come?
Right. We're not a very attractive attraction anymore.
Right.
And who knows how long that's going to last. And I think that maybe for our listeners who aren't in New York or even, you know, larger market cities, you know, it's hard to even think about this, but it's true. Even your most sort of basic local corner bar in New York still relies on tourism. You know, every time your friend comes to visit, you take them to your local. So, you know, bars that are inside of a hotel like yours or bars that like mine that have had some fortunate acclaim nationally and internationally, like people come to visit these bars. And if no one's coming to visit, then the bar is, you know, losing revenue there as well. And as you mentioned, consumer confidence is going to be super low when we can get back to letting people in. They're not going to want to be in these tight spaces.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's take a quick break, Maxwell, and hear from our sponsors here at Heritage Radio Network. We're going to come back and keep talking to you about Thirst and maybe a little bit about White Claw. Stay tuned, everybody.
This episode is brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. From the moment Route 11 dropped their first batch of chips back in the early days of 1992, they understood their destiny as a high-quality producer. Instead of succumbing to the frenzy of mass production, they took advantage of their small size and made chipping a personal art form. The payoff was immediate, an incredible potato chip. With a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. In this world of uncertainty that we live in, Route 11 Potato Chips believe comfort food can be just that. Know where your food comes from. To learn more, visit rt11.com.
And we're back. You were listening to The Speakeasy on Heritage Radio Network. Today we are joined in our virtual studio by Maxwell Britton of Thirst, which is an organization that's doing some really important stuff to try and, you know, the analogy that we use a lot on this show about saving the restaurant industry is bailing out the Titanic with a shot glass. You actually have a bucket and maybe even potentially some like a wet vac or some pumps that you could use. Talk to us about some actual tangible stuff that is you're working on right now that is very pressing, and what potentially the listener could do to support these actions if they're so moved.
Great. Awesome. Well, first of all, guys, I really, really want to thank you guys for the platform. It's this kind of advocacy that our organization really needs right now, is having advocates like you guys allowing us to speak about these issues and communicate. This is all, to me, this is just really all about distributing and communicating as much as we can about these issues. But the way that we operate is I like to think of us, even though we are a lobby group, I like to think of us more of a small business resource. There's a lot of businesses out there that they do have insurance, and they have all these things, but they might not even understand their policy. They might not even understand how to file a claim. So in the short term, that's something that we were trying to do, is just to help people file their claims. Because that's going to be a really important process for us when it comes down to changing up this legislation for the way that the bills for these policies are defined. So the big part of doing this is working on a local level. So we are a national organization, but we're really, really local. That's the way that we're scaling out our strategy. So every state in the country has an insurance policy group that's made up of state senators and assembly members. Those state senators and assembly members, they belong to different districts throughout their state. And so those districts are, zones all over the place. And so what we do is we actually have a team of law students have pretty much drafted up all of those districts for all of the states that we're working within. So once we've identified all the territories that one of these legislators are a part of, what we do is we'll go into that district and we identify somebody who is a business leader or a business owner within that district. And we appoint them as a community organizer. What their role is to basically canvass all of the businesses that are within their district, ask them to sign our petition, which is on our website. And our website is www.thirstgroup.org. And there's just a sign up right there. It takes 45 seconds. And really, all we need is somebody to provide us with their contact information, their location, address, et cetera. And then they'll also provide just like a brief testimony of what kind of economic hardship they might be experiencing due to the shutdowns that we're all experiencing right now. And so from there, once we've got a minimum, we're aiming for anywhere between 50 to 100 signatures from business owners within a given district. Once we've acquired that quota, we actually are in contact with the offices of the legislator of that territory. And we sit down with them. It would be one of our lawyers. We also have an insurance consultant that's a part of our steering committee. And then the community organizer from that district as well. We'll sit at the table with the policymaker, and what we do is we provide them details on the kinds of problems that this issue is creating, and then we also present a few different solutions that we could pursue as a compromise. If they're still not supportive at that point, then we also have the community organizer at the table, who's really kind of a spokesperson for all the small businesses of that given district. And they can basically say, listen, you know, I'm here representing on behalf of 100 small businesses who happen to be your constituents. And they all really need you to advocate for us in Albany when it comes time to vote on amending the way that this bill is interpreted. And if you don't feel like doing that, then once again, I've got 100 small business owners here that will be happy to let their community know not to vote for you at the next election. So we're definitely pressuring these policymakers pretty harshly, because one of their primary responsibilities is to take care of like the economic health of their districts. So they're actually kind of required to listen and hopefully also advocate.
I mean, it sounds like a little bit of strong arming, but that's exactly what lobbying is, right?
Yes.
It's using your network and your network being your net worth. You know, you're saying you got 100 businesses that all have a community of their own. So we're talking, if they each have 100 customers, that's, you know, we're looking at thousands of people pretty quickly that they could motivate to vote in different people to make changes in the future if we can't make them now. I mean, I think this all sounds fucking brilliant, and I can't believe that you and your team have come up with this so quickly. You know, we've been shut down since March, and I'm sure you didn't think of it on day one, right? But you've motivated so quickly.
Yeah, I mean, I do wish that we were a little bit further along, because this pandemic, it definitely moves a lot faster than we are. And you know that something changes every single day, and so there is I think we're definitely pretty far along, and we're also established right now in about, I think we're at like 12 or 13 states right now. We have state organizers set up, and all of them are in different places in terms of how they've, you know, how many signups and signatures they're getting. And so, you know, back to the whole call to action, you know, once again, is to sign up. But, you know, for everybody that's listening, regardless of whether or not you are a small business owner in any state and anywhere in this country, we still need your support, and you can still sign up. We still want to know where you are, and we still want to know that you support this. But we really do need to create awareness for small business owners, because we do need to help them, and we do have a long-term goal. But in the short term, we can still support these businesses by helping them file their claims, and so. It's really important that we share that information with everybody.
Absolutely. And this is, and the thing that I, you know, I've, like everybody else, been forced to think a lot more about lobbyists in the past 4 months than I really would have ever wanted to. But one thing that it seems to me is that, you know, I mean, first of all, like we talked about earlier, restaurant and bar folks are excellent at putting on hats that they've never worn before and just running with it. You know, it's like when you get promoted to your first GM job, it's like, congratulations, you've made awesome cocktails your entire career. You're a plumber now. Like, we're very adaptable. And I think also we're very good at talking to people and educating. And I think that, you know, there is definitely an aspect of lobbying that's like, speak softly but carry a big stick. You know, it's like you can definitely use the strong arm if you want to, but it also seems like a lot of the mission is, at least from what you're doing, is education, is going to these local politicians and saying, I don't know if you're aware of this, but what is happening isn't working, and it isn't working badly, and here's what we can do to fix it.
Right, exactly. Yeah, yeah, I mean, obviously, like, strong-arming people into doing something isn't necessarily what I want to do. But, you know, I'm also doing a lot of things that I wouldn't want to do right now, but I have to. I'm not going to, you know, I'm not too polite that I would not utilize that strategy to protect our industry and to protect my colleagues and my communities and all that sort of things, if that's what it comes down to. And that's exactly what we have to do. You know?
Exactly. If it's the right thing, fuck it. Strong-arm. You know
yeah,
what I mean?
Exactly. And I have no problem. I have no problem guilting somebody into supporting. I mean, and at the end of the day, I mean, I don't, this is going to make it sound like I'm guilting everybody who's listening into doing this. But at the end of the day, if you listen to the show, if you go to a cocktail bar, if you work in a bar, if you work in a restaurant, if you work at a food blog, or, you know, any other kind of industry adjacent type of business, then we all have a moral responsibility to support this issue. You know, it's like we're talking about it, like endangering our industry. And all it takes is 45 seconds to hop onto our website and just fill out this information. And if people want to do more than that, then they can also contact me, and we have like lots and lots of different kinds of roles and help that we need right now.
Right. I mean, I don't feel like you're guilting people into it. You're really calling people to an important, action that seemingly is pretty simple to undertake. Say the website again, Thirst.
It's www.thirstorg. I'm sorry, thirstgroup.org.
Thirstgroup.org. Cool. We'll make sure that's in the show notes as well. And I can hear the passion in your voice, and I understand it because I've known you for a long time, but maybe talk a little bit about what you think is so important about bars and restaurants in our society and community in general.
I mean, we risk losing so much. I mean, we can, take out, the economic aspects of the equation, all of the jobs that it represents and, like the supply chain that, most people don't even think about or know about, like the farm that, our fruit came from and the winery that we bought our wine from, so on and so forth, the paper that we buy, the linens that we get for the tablecloths. Like there's all kinds of different like business to businesses that are part of what we do. And so obviously, there's that economic issue where, all of these other businesses are endangered in addition to ours. But what we're also losing is community, and we're losing arts and culture. And we're also missing a very, very important aspect of human life, which is, the experiential and the social that, we all really need to survive. And that's what bars have always been for people. They've been that backdrop for those very important human life experiences that we all need. And they're community centers. And so we're risking losing community centers. We're risking some basic human experiences. There's so many different ways that bars really, really contribute to society. And I think it's really unusual because I don't think anybody would ever would have thought that this was going to happen. And so it's very, I don't know how to say this, like kind of jarring to begin to try to explain why this is such an important thing that we need to try to protect.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've had conversations, not just with bar people, with everybody, where they've said, oh my God, I can't wait until I can go back to a bar or a restaurant and just hang out again. But I can tell you exactly how many people have said, oh God, I can't wait to fly on an airplane again. It's zero.
Right.
Yeah, right. Totally. And we bailed them out and not us, right? So it seems like our priorities are way out of whack. But we knew that going into this. With the current administration, especially, I don't want to turn this into a political show, but we're all feeling the pinch, and we all know that it's coming from above. And again, I think I said it earlier, the government has shown their cards, and they kind of don't give a shit about us. And so now we have to advocate for ourselves. And so very happy to have you on, so we can amplify your voice, and very happy to have you out there doing this work. When did Thirst kind of crack open? When did you guys get this? Like, when did it go from idea to action?
I think we basically formed our steering committee in April, mid-April. Mm-hmm. And then actually we just recently filed our 501c6, which is what makes us a non-for-profit lobby group. That's also really important for me to say. We're all volunteer-based. Nobody is making money off of this. Everybody is donating their time. Also, if I had to estimate how much of our billable hours we've all put into this so far, because there's about like 50 people a part of our organization, like we're definitely talking hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of billable hours that we've put into this already.
Right.
I'm sure. Yeah. It's not lobbying is not easy.
Yeah. We started up in April. And then we just sort of began to scale things out. I think that I first started really pounding the pavement once I kind of understood how to do what we're doing, probably about like 6 or 7 weeks ago.
Sure. I mean, yeah, it's another learn as you go situation. I think that's another another attribute that's built into us, or at least trained into us over our careers in this field. You Either you come into it learning as you go, or you adapt to learning as you go. As you said, Greg, I'm a plumber. Fuck, I know more about plumbing today than I did when I started in my career. And you know, it's just part and parcel that we have to kind of learn on our feet and go. In the notes that we shared prior to the show going on air, you posed a question that you might want to touch on, and I'd like to touch on it with you too. And I don't know if you meant this directly correlating to the pandemic, or if you just meant this in general. But you said, "What do you think the future of the global cocktail community is? And why are cocktails important, and are they important at all anymore? What do you feel about that, Maxwell?"
Yeah, I mean, well, the reason why I asked that question is, you know, because we're sort of like, this is getting super existential, you know, for all of us, because we have to think about, like, we're beginning to describe to ourselves what is really a bar, and we've sort of put on this facade as professionals. We all have, over the years of our career, of being these, you know, beverage experts and cocktail experts. And, you know, we kind of have this certain air of notoriety about us because of, you know, our knowledge and experience in bars and beverage. But when you peel all those layers back, you know, we're just, like I said before, we're just creating a community center and creating like hospitable and hopefully safe environments for people to enjoy, you know, an alcoholic beverage. And I think you said to me, Southern, when we were on the phone last week, you were like, I'm concerned that, you know, every bar is going to be the same. We're all kind of homogenized at this point because we're all just kind of trying to do the same thing to stay open, to get people to come, you know, where everybody's got a frozen margarita on their menu now, and everybody's, you know, just kind to like do whatever they can to get business. So I all mean, these things that, I mean, that matter yeah, to us are out the window, you know?
Yeah, I would jump in there real quickly and just say, yeah, Amore Amargo, famously, you know, no sugar, no shaker, no juice. Currently, I'm serving, you know, and no vodka at my bar. Currently, I'm serving vodka hibiscus lemonade and a spicy jalapeno maple syrup margarita on my outdoor cafe. Nothing about this sounds right to me.
Right.
But I have to do it because it's difficult for me to expect that someone's going to sit outside literally in a parking space on the street in New York City in 97 degree weather and drink a Manhattan.
Right.
You know, I'm a fool if I think that's going to work. So I have to adapt. But then I look next door to the bar who's also on the sidewalk right next door to me, and he's got a vodka lemonade and a spicy margarita. And I look across the street, and they've got a vodka lemonade and a, you know, some kind of frozen margarita coming out of a frozen machine. You know, like, we all suddenly, the field has been cut down to a place where we're all kind of doing the same things and competing for those same few dollars that are out there. So it's really going to change. It's really going to change the landscape for, obviously, for the beginning of coming back to life, but who knows how long this will last.
Yeah, we've definitely been leveled out, you know, and it's just, you know, I think about like some of the conferences that we've attended and some of maybe even some of the lectures that you and I have probably done over the years, you know, and, you know, we're doing our classes on, you know, like for me, it might have been, you know, like forgotten absence of like mid-19th century, you know, but like now who the fuck cares about that, dude? Who fucking cares? Who cares? I can't even believe people would even go to that. Like, but so we afforded ourselves this, like, this luxury of like kind of like creating this art form that, you know, has become the global cocktail community over the last like 15, 20 years. And it's beautiful and it's awesome. And I do really still love all those things. And I, you know, I look forward to hopefully coming back to something like that again in the future. But I don't know if it's going to be the same by that time, because we're all kind of like been rocked to our core, and we have to confront like, what are our real values? Like, what's really important to me about my bar? Is it my fancy $18 cocktail that has all kinds of bizarre and like weird, crazy spirits that people have never heard of? Or is it just that like I'm creating a space for somebody to enjoy themselves amongst friends? You know, is it more important for me to be that cocktail guy? Or is it more important for me just to actually just have my business and create a good space for people to go to?
For people to go to, and also for people to come to and work. Like, I'm making these changes not because I'm excited to have people sit outside and drink margaritas. I'm making these changes because I still want to make sure that my team can live in the apartments they live in without having to move, or that they can, you know, literally put food on the table, you know. Like, I'm not just doing it for the people coming now, and I think always I was doing it for my team as well. And I've always been the preacher of specialize, and now suddenly I am all about homogenize. Let's just be the same as the guy next door because we got to capture those dollars.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I don't know the answer, man, but I do know that it's, you know, never going to be the same, and we're never going to forget this, no matter how this ends.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, what I was going to say earlier is, I think that, you know, I think there is a space for both. I think there is definitely a space to say, like, you know, we are creating this place that's both an enjoyable place to go to and an enjoyable place to work. And it's because of, you know, the fact that we take the time to get very inventive and creative, and that we're doing stuff in this space that nobody else is doing, that we can honestly look ourselves in the mirror and say, we are the best at this, you know, and I think there is a place for that. And I think there's a place for that, just like I've always said that there's also a place for, you know, the $5 shot in a beer bar. I love them both equally in totally different ways. One thing I'm kind of curious about when we come out of this is if, you know, one of the conversations we're having is, how do we put the industry back together better than it was? And one component of that is charging what stuff actually costs, like getting rid of all the kind of like artificial price cuts that are built into the fact that you can sell, you know, an oyster for a dollar at happy hour, or that you can sell, maybe not in New York City, but you can sell like an $8 hamburger. And I get, to me, it's more of a question of like, will people charge what cocktails are actually worth? Like, will people be willing to charge what mezcal is actually worth, which is about three times what we actually pay for it? I don't know. That's the biggest question mark for me, I think.
Yeah, I've definitely gone through some of those things as a business owner, thinking about putting together my reopening strategy. Although, of course, I still don't know when I'm ever going to get to reopen my bar at this point. But I still have put together, you know, a plan for, you know, how we're going to try to get it back up on its feet. And yeah, of course, you got to look at the cost of things and all that sort of stuff. And it's pretty interesting. I'm not sure if, I mean, everybody's going to do the same thing or not. I mean, I just recently went to a bar. I won't say the name of it. And I got one of these, you know, frozen fruity cocktails, and it was $20 for that. And I got two of them, like one for me and one for a friend. And then I, you know, tipped, you know, $15. And so, you know, I was like almost in the hole, $60 for two drinks. And, you know, normally I might ask if that was actually what people are charging, or if that was a mistake or something, because that's like an insane amount of money to pay for a frozen drink. You know, I realized that they needed to charge that for their bar. They needed to. That's how they're trying to pay their bills. And so, you know, I'm totally in support of that. So I think some people will do that. I think other people will do the opposite. There's like a Mexican restaurant up the street from where I live, and they've got a $7 frozen margarita on their menu. So, you know, I think everyone's just trying to figure out how they can get a piece of the pie, or rather how they're going to strategize how to make it work. You know, do I want to sell four $7 margaritas, or do I want to sell three $20 margaritas?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And how do we balance that out with cost of goods and margins, et cetera? Man, yeah. This has been a really eye-opening conversation, Maxwell. I really appreciate you being here on the show. Once again, this was Maxwell Britton from the Django at the Roxy Hotel here in New York City. He's one of the on the steering committee of Thirst, which again is thirstgroup.org. Go there now. It's a 45-second form for you to fill out to support, and hopefully will help a lot of restaurants get out of the trouble that they're in right now. You can also find Maxwell on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, all at his name, Maxwell Britton with two T's. So please follow him, support him, and you know, let's help each other dig out of this hole. So thanks again, Maxwell, for being on the show with us.
Sounds good, man. Thank you so much.
Like, really important stuff, and frankly, I don't feel like we had enough time, so we'll probably have you back on to follow up about what's going on.
Yeah, I'd love to keep you guys updated. That would be awesome. And thank you again for giving me a platform and everybody in the hospitality industry, you know, the chance to support us, and hopefully in turn we'll be supporting them.
Yeah. Well, all right, guys. Thanks so much for tuning into this episode of The Speakeasy. Look forward to having you sit in with us again. Cheers, everybody. Thanks again.
Cheers, cheers, man.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll, Lord. Knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The devil runs his groove in them rhythm and blues that sin. It's gonna get you some in the end.
The Speakeasy is powered by Simplecast.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork.
Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows that you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.